You remember our friend AJ Mass, who writes about fantasy sports for a four-letter sports network and its website, which, for the purposes of this interview, I'm not allowed to say what it is, but it stands for Extrasensory Perception Network. .com. That doesn't give anything away, does it?
I think you covered yourself there very nicely.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one-third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 270, Time Travel Tales. In honor of Groundhog Day, which was last Thursday, and is, of course, the great alternate history time travel comedy starring Bill Murray, AJ Mass and I set out to identify our top 10 favorite time travel stories. Due to some weird glitch in the space Skype continuum, AJ's voice seems to be coming out of two alternate universes at the same time. But if the sound quality doesn't drive you crazy, he and I will talk about Stephen King's latest time travel novel, 112263, and try to articulate what it is about the notions of time travel that appeal to us so much.
You know, I like the fact that there has to be an internal logic to time travel stories. I really, to me, it's first of all, time travel, you know, it's all hypothetical. So for someone to say, I get a lot of plays with time travel stories, like, well, that time travel story, well, that's not the way time travel works, okay? And right off the bat, I'm just like, hello. Until we actually establish somewhere that time travel does work, we don't know how it works. So, you know, as long as you have an internal logic to the time travel story. So I think time travel stories lend themselves to better writing, more interesting stories when done well, because they have to follow this elaborate, sometimes latticework of you know, sequence of events without any paradoxes. And I think it's just harder to do, so I just appreciate it more when they pull it off.
And it covers – time travel stories cover a lot of ground generally, because there's not only the science of it in whatever way the author decides he wants to write about the science, but then there's the reasons why one goes back, which are intensely personal and character-driven and or socio-political. And then there's the whole historical aspect of knowing the history of what you're writing about, or knowing or speculating about what the alternative histories would have been if you somehow managed to change history.
Yeah, I do think it is. It's kind of this nice little guessing game that we play with, like the road, you know, the path not taken, and what would have happened if that had happened. I think we all, every one of us, has moments in our lives where we go, you know, I really wish I could have gone that back to that moment in my life,
right?
And maybe done it differently. And you know what? Personally, I have found, like, I used to like really be excited about that, because, you know, there were days like that I wish I could go back, and I would, you know, daydream about, like, well, what would happen. But you know what? I'm at a point where in my life now where there's a deadline. There's like a firm line in the sand there where, like, I'm not going back past before my son was born, because I ain't risking my son not being born.
Huh? Yeah, interesting. And most of the time in most time travel stories, the guys who go back are loners, are single people without connections to the present.
And with nothing to lose.
And I think that's one of the it's funny. I think that the time travel story is a Rorschach test, that revealing all about the person who's talking about it. In your case, it's the precision of the that goes into the creation of the story. For me, it's like the great time travel stories for me are romances. There's not only the romance of going back to an earlier time, an earlier, usually presumed to be better and idyllic time. But rarely is that the case. But so often, as I look down the list of things that the top 10 list of my favorite time travel stories, they're also personal romances. Whether it's romantic romance or relationships between parents and children, that's what's so appealing to me. I think it appeals to the romantic in you. And if you don't, a lot of people, I think, who don't like science fiction stories so much still like time travel stories. It's like a gateway drug.
Yeah, I can see that, and you're absolutely right. It's like part of the problem with a lot of the bad time travel stories that are out there, I think, is that You know, there's no stakes involved.
Yeah.
If you can always go back and try again, then, you know, I don't really care if you succeed or don't succeed this time because you just go back and try again. It's when you add that added level of personal stakes, you know, like I said, the romance, you know, if there's a relationship there that you know, heightens the drama, you know, that takes it to another level and it raises it, elevates it above the ones that are just like, oh, well, yeah, we'll try it again. No, we'll try it again. Okay, you did some cool special effects. Well, I'm not really interested in that.
Right. You first posited the idea of us having this conversation about time travel last year, just as Stephen King's latest book, 11/22/63, came out. And we both agreed, no, let's wait and finish reading that book, the most recent great time travel book, and talk about it then. Now, having read it, does 11/22/63 make it to your top 10 list of time travel stories?
It's on the list. Yeah, it was really well done. I you know, it's Stephen King, so you know it's like about 63,000 pages long.
Yes, I agree. I thought it was extremely well done, and I thought it kind of. I think it's kind of his new next high water mark. Did this surprise you? I was surprised that the story is called 11/22/63. He's writing a story about a guy who's going back trying to prevent the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And the book is almost, what is it, 700, 800? It's 850 pages long.
Right.
And he doesn't even get to the assassination until probably the last 100 pages, and yet it's a page-turner anyway. He's figured out how to make a compelling, all the aspect of all the mechanics of going back in time, he actually made really compelling.
Well, and the two things that about that, first of all, to go off on a quick tangent, is that time travel stories, I've always said, if there was like a TV show that focused on time travel, you know, the Quantum Leaps, Early Edition, things like that, I always thought, you know, the show has run out of ideas when they suddenly involve the JFK assassination. That, to me, was the surefire sign, oh, they've run out of ideas, because every single show has done it. And at some point in the future, 9/11 will replace JFK assassination. Is that, oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
You're going there? Because there's so many stories you could tell. I always thought, you know, you run out of ideas when you did that. So the fact that he did a whole book about this, I was skeptical going in. Because I was like, oh, Sarah, here we go again. We're going to see an Oliver Stone kind of thing, and da, 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 da. But what I really, really found fascinating about this book was that not only is it time travel in the sense that the main character of the story goes back in time, not only did he have this brilliant idea of saying he can only go back in time to 5 years before the assassination, so he has to live through the 5 years to get to that date, so which takes care of that, oh, I can go back again and again and again. It's a lot to go back again and again and again. If you have lived 5 years and you're getting older,
right,
as you do it. So, like, he took that aspect out of it. But also, he used it as a chance to revisit one of his own works. He visited the town where It took place and visited some of the characters from It.
Right.
And I thought, what a great thing to put into a book about time travel, that he himself transported all of us back in time to characters that we read about so long ago. I just thought that was such a brilliant way to suck you in.
Well, I totally agree, and It is not really the only book he's revisiting. I realize that that structurally the book bears a lot of resemblance to The Dead Zone, where a man loses like 5 years of his life in the case of The Dead Zone in a coma. He comes out of it with the power to see the future. He sees a politician getting elected and destroying the world, so he has to then become an assassin. So in the same, that's almost the exact same structure. Although in the case of 11/22/63, he's got to prevent an assassination. But he's also, it was one of the few Stephen King books that I've read, and Dead Zone was the other, where I sort of teared up in one or two spots as the relationship with his girlfriend get kind of ebbs and flows. It's like he's created these characters and these relationships where I'm really involved in their relationship, and forgetting all about the time travel imperative. The other thing I that he did that I think is so great is that because he's Stephen King, and unlike other writers of time travel stories, he personified time as a sort of a malevolent, or he says, obdurate force. And he makes time itself an antagonist, it quite specifically. And like the like some of the settings in Derry, he turns the book depository in Dallas into a sort of a malevolent building, like the Overlook Hotel in The Shining, like the Kitchener Ironworks in It, like the hotel on the Northern California coast at the end of The Talisman. You know, these...
What I found was really cool about that is that, you know, he starts off with this time travel story, and like you said, he then, like, stops, and then spends, like, you know, a good 200-250 pages developing this relationship, which could have been a completely different book. You know, guy goes into a small town, you know, meet with a dark past that he's trying to keep secret and falls in love. And he really – he stays there. And, you know, it occurred to me as I'm reading this, like, you know, I get it. This character is killing time.
Yeah.
So of course, time's going to fight back because he's killing time.
Hello, my name's Jasper Ford. I'm the author of the Thursday Next series of books and also the Nursery Crime series of books, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This winter, spring, and summer of 2012, you'll be able to RSC us in 34 cities in the U.S. and the U.K., cities like Fairfield, Connecticut, Stowe, Vermont, Reston, Virginia, New Bremen, and New Philadelphia, Ohio, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, Waverly, Iowa, Tacoma and Edmonds, Washington, Sonoma and Santa Rosa, California, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma in May, and then we head over to the UK, to York, Buxton, Exeter, Newbury, Nottingham, Truro, Poole, Tunbridge Wells, Canterbury, Leamington Spa, Derby, Hereford, Rhyl, Barnsley, Salford, Lichfield, Basingstoke, Crawley, Bedford, Tewkesbury, and London. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with AJ Mass as we launch into our top 10 time travel tales, beginning with AJ's number 10.
I'm going to start with the TV show Quantum Leap. At number 10.
Good.
You know, I thought that was just a great use of storytelling. It's you know, to depict the time traveler as not knowing what's going on and having to figure it out. So because he was trying to figure it out each week, we had to figure it out with him, and he was our representative. I just thought that was a very clever way of getting us involved in the main character each week. Because an anthology show just usually does not work on television today. And this was a great, you know, I think this might have been the last great anthology-style show.
All right. What's your number nine?
Number nine is a show that a lot of people probably didn't see. It's called True Calling. Oh. It starred Eliza Dushku. Mm-hmm. And it was unceremoniously canceled in the middle of its second season. So it ended on a cliffhanger of sorts.
Interesting.
Which is very frustrating. But essentially, Eliza Dushku was this character who... every day she would wake up, the start of each episode, she would live a day and then she'd wake up 24 hours earlier knowing that she had to save someone's life. She worked in a morgue as a morgue assistant, and the dead body would actually wake up and ask her for help. And she'd have to go back and try and figure out how they died. And, you know, she only kind of knew what she knew as the body was wheeled in kind of thing. So it was like half detective show, but she had 24 hours to fix it. You know, it was a strict timeline, and she, you know, she couldn't go back again and again and again. And what they did on that show that was very interesting was they introduced a nemesis in the second season, played by Jason Priestley, who was also going back to reliving the same 24 hours, but he was trying to kill people. He was trying to make sure they died. So he was trying to save them. He was trying to make sure they died. And there was a really good philosophical debate over which one was right. Who's the one playing God?
Yeah.
Because he was just resetting the timeline. She was changing the timeline. And who was really doing the most damage? And in a surprisingly dramatic and really subdued role, Lazuscu's boss was Zach Galifianakis before anyone knew who he was. And he was really good, but in a dramatic, serious role.
Cool. Okay, cool. Keep going with number eight.
All right, number eight was an episode of The Outer Limits, the old science fiction anthology series with Martin Landau was on it. I don't remember the name of the episode, but he played a man from the future named Andro, who was coming back in time to kill the man who was responsible for nuclear Armageddon. Wow. And he comes back too soon. So he ends up encountering the parents of this nefarious child. Very Terminator-esque before Terminator.
Okay.
And so instead of, he falls in love with the mother-to-be of the guy who's going to destroy the world. So he decides he's going to take her back in his spaceship to the future and you know, therefore change the timeline. Mm. And of course, you know, we're a little bit more savvy to time travel now. But it's still impactful when he gets her in his spaceship and takes her to the future. Spoiler alert, everybody, I won't spoil the ending. But he takes her to this, you know, the spaceship and travels to the future. She agrees to go with him because she's falling in love with him. And he goes, yeah, but we're going to a world where I don't exist. And he just vanishes.
Ooh, nice. All right. Number seven.
Number seven. This is another show that a lot of people didn't see. It was on very briefly. It's called Journeyman. Or Journeyman, depending on how you wanted to pronounce it.
Mm-hmm.
It starred Kevin McKidd, the guy who plays Owen on Grey's Anatomy, for all you Grey's Anatomy fans.
Mm-hmm.
Again, without an accent. I don't know how he does it. But just a fascinating story where he has no control over it. He just zaps back through time to another point in time, and then, you know, zaps back when he does the job, whatever it is, and he's trying to figure out why he's going back in time. So he's, you know, it's, again, a bit of the exploratory process. But there was one moment for me that just elevated the show to a level, and I'm a parent, and I totally relate to this. He has a son, and he goes back, gets zapped back into time and makes some sort of change, and when he comes back, he no longer has a son. He has a daughter.
Oh.
And he doesn't remember this daughter at all. So he wants it now. He can't wait for the next time to go back in time, to go back and change what he had just changed so that his son comes back. And his wife is adamantly against it because she only knows the daughter.
Right.
And, you know, they have this huge blow up, and it's so about, you know, the emotional impact of the romance, like you're saying. The emotion where she is so defensive of her daughter and he is doing the right thing in that he's defensive of the son, who's the only one he knows, and they're both right, and they're both, like, there's no right answer to this. Like, it's just this Mexican standoff, if you will, you know, where, like, what do you do in that situation? It's a situation that could only exist in time travel, but it was so emotionally intense, it just, you know, ripped me apart.
Cool. Well, now, So far, we don't have any none of those things you just mentioned, your first five, your first four, are on my list at all. So keep going. What's your number six?
All right, number six, not entirely 100% time travel, but there is time travel involved, and it's Donnie Darko. Which is my favorite film of all time. Just a great story of, you know, we get to the question of whether alternate universes are really time travel or if it's a separate, you know, entity of itself, kind of like a la Sliders, TV show.
Right.
Which is way too campy to have made this list. But, yeah, you know, Donnie Darko is just a great story of a kid who wakes up one morning and, you know, he's a sleepwalker and he gets summoned out of his house by this vision he has of a giant humanoid rabbit.
Right.
Who tells him that the world's going to end in 28 days, and when he gets back to his house, he sees that a plane engine has fallen through the roof of his house and would have crushed him while he slept had he not sleptwalked.
Yeah.
And the whole movie is a journey as he kind of figures out that the only way to stop the world from ending is to go back in time to just before the engine drops and actually die.
Yeah. That's Donnie Darko was definitely on my honorable mention list. Absolutely. And for reasons that I have another movie on there instead. All right, go on. What's number five?
Number five is the Butterfly Effect.
Yeah.
Even though it's not the greatest movie of all, and Ashton Kutcher cannot act to save his life. Worst thing about the movie is Ashton Kutcher.
The star.
The star of the film. But what I loved about the film is how consistent it is in the storytelling. Mm. And a lot of people try to poke holes in it, and there really aren't any holes in it at all, which is why it's great because you're watching it the first time. And the first time through the timeline, when you see Ashton Kutcher as a kid, he blacks out from time to time. He has these blackouts. And the blackouts, you're watching, you're seeing the show, and all you see are the stream of events with the blackouts, and you don't know what happens to these blackouts. And as the movie goes on, and we get into future Ashton, as it were, he starts to travel back in time, and you realize he's traveling back in time to the moments of these blackouts. So it's very consistent that the reason that young Ashton doesn't remember these moments is because future Ashton has taken over the consciousness, and two objects can't occupy the same space at the same time. So, it's consistent through this theoretical physics kind of thing that I really enjoy.
Okay, continue. Number four.
Number four is Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Okay.
Which surprisingly, not the entire movie.
No, just one kind of slim thread.
Just the part of the movie that consists of the kids going back in time and kind of doing things from, and you're seeing it from the other angle. You're seeing it from the other perspective because these things actually did happen the first time they went through this part of the movie, but now you're seeing it from the other angle, and it's very consistent and explains a lot of the things that didn't make sense the first time through. It's the best movie of the Harry Potter series, I think. Mm-hmm. It's the first one that went dark. It wasn't like Christopher Columbus and the kids, la la la. But the time travel aspect of it, they nailed it.
All right, we're getting to the end of the list. What's your number three? We need Ryan Seacrest here for this. What's your number three?
Well, we'll get to that after the break. No. number three, Back to the Future. Mm-hmm. One and two only, not three. Three just took the concept too far, but because one and two are kind of like, a continuation, two is such a continuation of the first one. And yes, technically three is a continuation of two, but it's so awfully done. Just take that one out of the mix. But I just think Back to the Future, if for nothing else, that it provides the template, an explanation for all people who don't know anything about time travel movies and don't understand it, is right in the movie when, Doc Brown in the Back to the Future movies just stands there and explains time travel to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And just the chalkboard is like, you went from 1985 to the future, but if you go back along that timeline, you actually have to go back before the point. Just the explanation is just perfect, and it really delineates between the two types of time travel movies, the open universe and closed universe.
Mm-hmm.
In the open universe, you can make changes.
Yeah.
And that's what Back to the Future is. I mean, it's all about making these changes. Closed universe, you can't make changes. And closed universe time travel stories usually don't work because there's no risk. Because, if you can't change it, then there's no risk to changing things. And therefore, you can't will yourself out of existence by making a mistake if it's closed universe. So it's really hard to pull off a closed universe story with high stakes.
All right, number two.
Number two is 12 Monkeys.
Yeah, okay.
12 Monkeys, because this is the only closed universe time travel story I've ever seen that really packed an emotional wallet for me.
Yeah.
And I just think, Bruce Willis is part from a future where a virus has killed most of the population that live underground, and he's in prison, and he's volunteered for a project to go sent back in time to figure out where the virus came from in order to save the future.
Mm.
But it's not a change the past kind of thing. He's going to bring he's going to bring that information to the future, and they're going to advance from that point on.
Go ahead, number one.
Number one is the best time travel movie ever made. Very few people have seen it. It's called Primer.
Oh, yes, I have seen it.
It is by far the most complex.
It's about the guys in the garage, right?
The guys in the garage. Yeah. These guys, it's shot on no budget. It's a no-budget film. I think it maybe cost $8,000 to make the entire film. Mm-hmm. And so quality-wise, some of the sound is a little off, and some of the visuals are a little off. But from a storytelling standpoint, they go so deep. You have to watch this movie like 3 or 4 times just to figure out what's going on.
Right.
But it really is an airtight plot. There is nothing wrong with it.
I absolutely agree. It didn't have the emotional component, so it didn't make my list. But in fact, only 2 of the things that you mentioned are on my list. And I'll also go from number 10 to number 1. I think so much of what makes a list is how it hits you and at what age it hits you. But this my number 10 is a story that I don't even know the title of. I read it as a comic book, but I think it was a comic book adaptation, or what we would now call a graphic novel adaptation, of a short story about a guy who's not a religious man, but he has access to a time machine, and he goes back to the days of Jesus to hopefully restore his faith. And when he gets there, he finds that Jesus is sort of a babbling, retarded child in what way, and not at all the divine Son of God that he was anticipating. And so he realizes that he has to become the historical and mythic Jesus that we all know. And I thought, wow, that's, and I wish I've searched for this story in it, because I've never been able to find it, but it's such a great notion that you go back searching for something and have to become the thing you're searching for. And if anybody knows the title of this story about the guy who goes back and becomes Jesus, I would love to know it. My number 9 is the Ray Bradbury story where we first heard the mention of the butterfly effect, and it's called A Sound of Thunder. It's just a sort of a seminal work, you know? The notion that you go back and, you know, you step on a butterfly and in centuries, millennia to come, the world is completely destroyed or changed in some irreversible way. My number 8 is 12 Monkeys. The thing that I like that stays with me the most about it is that, and it's something that comes up in Stephen King's book 11/22/63 as well, this notion that time travel messes with your head, it changes you, it, you know, it F's you up. There are Stephen King calls it harmonics, like the past harmonizes. You get these echoes of things, and the thing I like about 12 Monkeys is that you can see the echoes messing with Bruce Willis's character and sort of transforming him. So it's like you go back into the time stream, and the stream has pollutants in it that can change you. And that's one of the aspects that I don't recall from too many other time travel stories. My number 7, talk about romance, is Somewhere in Time. The Christopher Reeve, Jane Seymour romantic chick flick based on a Richard Matheson short story called Bid Time Return. And it's this, the thing that appeals to me about it is three things. The leads are winning and appealing. The notion that you can hypnotize yourself back into the past by divorcing yourself, ridding yourself of all associations with the present, is an interesting low-tech way of achieving time travel. And then that shot of the penny that sends him back to the present still makes me gasp, no matter how many times I've seen it. It's just this great, shocking moment. My, what was that, 7? So I guess 6 is You Will Not Be Surprised to be a tie between 2 Star Trek episodes. One, from Star Trek The Next Generation, Yesterday's Enterprise. I'm sure you know it.
Of course.
Of course. The one where the Enterprise D goes back, goes through a temporal anomaly, right? Is that what we call it?
That's the best way to describe it. We don't have the science to describe it, so we'll just call it something, yeah.
So they go back to a point 23 years in the past, and in the new present, the Enterprise is a ship of war, not a ship of peace and exploration, and they have to figure out a way to get back. And crew member Security Chief Tasha Yar, who has been killed 2 seasons before, is now back as the current Security Chief, and she realizes, wait, she's not supposed to be here. She has some sort of outside of time awareness that she shouldn't be here. And so they have to kind of destroy the Enterprise to get back to the correct timeline. And that's tied with an episode from Deep Space Nine called The Visitor. It's the one with Captain Sisko's son is caught. Sisko and his son are caught in an explosion that kills Sisko, played by Avery Brooks, the lead of the show. And yet the story starts off with this very, very, very old man who's clearly about to die and is mourning something. You find out that this old man is Sisko's son, now as an old man who has lived his entire life with the knowledge not only that his father died in this explosion, but that every so often over the course of his long life, his father has continued to appear to him because of, again, some sort of weird temporal anomaly thing. So all of his life, this boy has to spend his entire life figuring out a way to get back to the moment where he can save his father. And it's just, you know, and I was moved by this even before I was a parent. Now I'm doubly, triply, fourply moved by it, where the son gets his father back, and they're both aware of what they lost and what they have refound. Just a great hour of television, great hour of story, even if you don't even know who these characters are.
Yeah, I will say I should have prefaced my list by saying I was taking all Star Trek universe stories out of it because there are just far too many good ones to select one. I just said, you know what, I could easily just throw City on the Edge of Forever in there, but I'm just going to take them all out.
Yes, yeah, no, exactly right. Instead, you gave us Ashton Kutcher. Whatever. Then I'm going to put 11-22-63 at number 5. Then it's so appropriate that we're talking about this today, February 2nd,
yes.
Groundhog Day. And yes, it's kind of an alternate history kind of a thing, but there is this reset button, but it is so consistent and so character filled and so full of comedy and so touching at the end where this guy becomes a better person. It's just a great movie.
And I think the thing that it proves is that you don't have to explain why it's happening. If their story is and your characters are interesting enough, then you don't have to explain why it started. You don't have to explain why it ended. It just when he grew to the point where the story reached a conclusion, you know, it moved on.
So then my number 3, like you, is also Back to the Future for all the reasons that you said. And I'll include the third movie too, just because it's like, okay, that's the end. I get it. That's the end of the story. Number two and my number one are both novels.
Okay.
And number two is a novel by Stephen Fry, you know, the humorist, the raconteur.
I love Stephen Fry, but I haven't read any of his books, but I think I'm about to.
Well, his books are great, and this book is his best. It's called Making History. And it is... It's a story about a guy, a Cambridge student, probably not unlike a young Stephen Fry, who stumbles into a situation where he can go back and kill Adolf Hitler. And it's that story. You go, okay, here we go. But the way he does it, the science of it, the what happens when he does succeed, how he has to fix it. I mean, it goes sort of exactly where you think a story like this is going to go, but it takes really interesting side trips to get there. It's one of those books I've read 4 or 5 times, and it's always entertaining.
Excellent.
So, Making History by Stephen Fry, number 2. Now, my number 1, and this is not. This is the number one of a lot of people's on a lot of people's list. It's Time and Again by Jack Finney, a sort of a classic of the genre, but it's also a classic kind of sci-fi. Jack Finney wrote not only Time and Again and other assorted time travel short stories. He also wrote the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the book, the serialized story on which all the other on all the movies are based. Time and Again. It's about a guy in the New York City in the early 1970s who hates how dirty it is, how noisy it is, how fraught with racial prejudice it is. yearns for a simpler time, and then gets involved in a government project that allows him to go back and just go back in time. It's fascinating how a bureaucratic government project would go about trying to do time travel. But then again, for the reasons that I love time travel stories, it's a romance. Not only does he have a romanticized view of the past, but he goes back and has a romantic relationship that it runs in conflict with the romantic relationship he's got going on in the present. And again, like all the classic time travel stories, he has to go back and do what he does without changing the present, and that becomes a real dilemma.
Right.
And again, it's one of those stories, one of those books that, you know, I recommend it to people, and I say, I'm so jealous that you now get to read this for the very first time, because I can't anymore. But I read it to my son when he was younger. I'm reading it to my daughter now. And it's just this also compelling, page-turning, idiosyncratic tale told well.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. I edited our chat down from almost a 50-minute conversation. If for some inexplicable reason you'd care to hear the entire conversation, let me know and I will go back in time and fix it. Send us your favorite time travel tales via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on our website podcast page, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks as always to webmaster Matt Rippey, his own grandfather Matthew Croke, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Tony Whitmore. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Jasper Ford, whose latest book in his internationally best-selling Thursday Next series, One of Our Thursdays Is Missing, has just come out in paperback here in the U.S. Thursday Next also dabbles in time travel and the worlds of literary detectives and juris fiction. Go check out all of Jasper's deceptively serious and silly novels at Jasper Ford. That's with two F's and an E at the end at jasperford.com. Finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 270/810 of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
That was, time-consuming?
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less.